Kentucky Psychologist, a podcast brought to you by the Kentucky Psychological Association. The Kentucky Psychologist will get into the minds of top psychologists from Kentucky and occasionally friends from across the country. We'll talk about what leading mental health experts are interested in and excited about. Hear about all the ways psychologists in clinical practice, research, leadership, and applied settings are doing to improve and save lives. All right. Thank you all for joining us on this episode of the Kentucky Psychologist. Today we have Don Rogers with us, who has been a KPA member and has been active on our board for quite some time. Thank you for joining us, Don.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So we'll get right into this. So Don, go ahead and give us a quick little bio about what you do and what you're doing now as where you're at in life.
Okay. Well, in 2020, I retired from New Vista, the community mental health center that serves Central Kentucky, based in Lexington, and I worked my whole career there. And so in 2021, I went for about 6 months and served as the interim CEO of Comprehend, the community mental health center up in Maysville. And all the while, I was sort of firing up a new career as a musician, as a professional musician. I've played music my whole adult life, and balanced that against my work in mental health, which is actually a great balance. It's always been very helpful to me to both be creative as a musician and to just learn instruments, play, and sort of use music as a form of meditation, I think has really helped me all along the way with what can be a fairly stressful job, and especially in community mental health, but really in all of mental health. But since then, November of 2021, I guess it was, I've been playing music. I have a few bands that I play with. My primary band that I play with is a band called the Local Honeys, and they're a national touring band. Although we're not touring super heavy this year, we do have some pretty big festivals we're playing, and a little tour coming up in July out to Montana and back. Also play and record with some other musicians, folks like Nicholas Jamerson, Cole Chaney, Lance Rogers. The Marble Creek Rangers is my primary band. And then I record and perform my own music. So that's what I'm up to these days. As far as psychology, my involvement right now is that I am a member of KPA. I was on the board until the beginning of this year, serving most recently as the rural rep. Otherwise, I am active in APA on a working group that is connected with the Board of Professional Affairs. The working group is tasked with coming up with recommendations for master's level practice regarding title and scope of practice for masters. And this work group has been going on since January of last year, 2022. And we will finish up our work in June. We'll have our final recommendations. And it's actually been very busy. It's been an active process. I've been on several of the subcommittees working on writing things up for the group and that sort of thing, but it's been very interesting. It's really my first involvement with APA. Otherwise, I do still participate in some of the advocacy events and so forth of KPA and keep informed on as well as I can on the policies regarding mental health in Kentucky, laws and so forth. So that's where I am these days.
Don's one of our first retired guests on our show, and he's also our first master's level psychologist. So you've got a unique position here on this episode. So I first want to get to the root of KPA. What first got you involved with KPA?
Well, I first got involved with KPA probably about 10 years ago after working in psychology for several years. When I got into a higher level leadership role at NuVista, one of my closest working partners and my supervisor, the person who hired me into my first region-wide leadership role, was David Hanna. David Hanna is a psychologist that had worked his whole career at the same organization and had been somewhat of a mentor to me in my early days. He did some specialized supervision with me on some projects. He did a lot of training for our organization and was just one of the highly regarded folks in our organization. And of course, I have gone to KPA conferences for years. So I've seen Dave there in various roles on the board and so forth. But he really talked to me about the benefits of KPA and the action of KPA. And I think what really stuck with me is KPA's really two things. One is the KPA's commitment to psychology having an impact, a positive impact on society in general. And that's integrated into mission statements, and then you see it all along. You know, if you look at the legislative action issues that come up in KPA, they're not just about what is going to, you know, protect the careers of psychologists, but it's really, I would say, even more of an emphasis on what about psychology can make the world a better place, and what about our current policies that are being focused on impacts that. And really that synced up very well with my reasons for getting into this to begin with, which was really to try to spend my life making a living and making the world a better place at the same time. And there's really not a lot of professions that allow you to do that in a way that's as clear and direct as psychology. So the other thing, I said there were two reasons that really rang with me in those early, when Dave was first talking to me about it, is KPA's commitment to master's level practice. KPA has for many years been committed to making sure that our state recognizes folks trained at the master's level and allows them a pathway to practice. That is not the case with the majority of states across the country. There are less than half of states that allow any master's level practice at all, and many of them don't allow independent practice at the master's level. KPA has been fully committed to that for quite a while. So that's my, and it just very soon after I became a KPA member, somebody recommended me for the treasurer of KPA. And so that was my first involvement on the board, just really a couple years after I got involved with KPA at all. And my background in operations and leadership at the community mental health center I was working at really helped, you know, me be able to serve in that role. I did two terms in that role. So for 4 years, I was working as the treasurer.
I guess we can give a huge shout out to Dave Hanna then for giving the plug to keep you and get you involved with KPA. So that's awesome. And we have not heard his name on the podcast yet. So I'm excited that he was the one that helped get you here or involved with KPA.
Yes. And that's one of many things that Dave did to help with my career and not just like to help really mentor me and make me a better professional.
That's awesome. So quickly just talked about how you got involved with KPA. We're going to go back a little bit further. What made you decide that you wanted to pursue a career in psychology? I know you quickly based on it or touched on it about how you wanted to make the world like a better place. But was there any other things that like, we were like, this is why I want to pursue psychology?
I really think, I mean, just to go a step back before that, when I was in high school, I was not a good student and really was not sure that I wanted to go to college. But fortunately, I came to age at a time when college was pretty affordable in the late 80s. And it was the majority of people that were in my peer group and really in my school, in my high school, went to college. So it was just kind of, I don't know what else to do. So I went to college and did not do well my first semester, but then decided after that, there's really no point in going. I don't have to go. So I can either buckle down and make the best of this or just go back home and work on a farm or something, you know? So I decided to really commit myself and started making better grades and getting more academically, you know, engaged. And I didn't know what major to declare. So I just kind of on a whim just declared psychology as a major and started taking a bunch of psychology classes. And early on, my intro psychology classes, like the first level, you know, 100 series psychology classes, had all of this great literature about how science and human problems, you know, work together and how you can make these discoveries about human nature that are not just intuitions, but really have empirical, you know, foundations to them. I loved that. And I didn't really know anything about what a psychologist does or how you turn that into a career. But that stuff to this day, I still love even non-clinical related psychology stuff about cognitive science and social science and all that stuff. So that was the first hook. And then, you know, I went to Eastern Kentucky University for my undergrad. And I had some really good mentors there that just helped sort of guide me along. And I will say that I think the universities could probably do a better job of educating their students about what a career in psychology could be and how what the reality of that is, not just like, here's a description of this, that, or the other, but really what the pathway could be. Because I know, and this was 30 years ago, but still yet, I felt like I was just like opening my eyes to a new discovery on my own or with my classmates as the process unfolded. But anyway, my commitment to trying to do something useful in society, along with my interest in psychology science, really, I think was the first spark to get me to apply for graduate schools and so forth. So I went to Morehead State Clinical Psychology Master's Program, and it just kept getting better as far as the knowledge base and my interest and engagement with all that stuff all along the way. I loved it. And I, you know, to some extent regretted not having been a better student in my earlier days, but was more grateful for just having a sort of second chance at, you know, at academic, you know, pursuits through the generosity of people who said, yeah, come on in. You seem like you got good enough sense to, you know, to do this.
Yeah, I find that, you know, regret, but you wouldn't have had those, you know, choices for life now if you hadn't made those choices, maybe with those grades back then. So I'm glad, you know, maybe you had that second chance to be where you're at now.
Right. I look back on all that, I realized that nobody in my family, the generation before me, my parents, their siblings, nobody had college degrees, and especially not professional, you know, master's degrees and so forth. So my whole family, you know, they're smart people, but they just weren't involved in that, you know, sort of higher ed, you know, thing. So it was, I'm grateful for having found my way through this.
We are very grateful as well. So we touched on that. So what were some challenges besides your academic first semester that you faced in your career of psychology, and how did you work to overcome those challenges?
Well, there's a little bit of a challenge in the for me especially, when I entered the community mental health system, which was really one of the few places that a master's level psychologist could work, because of you needed to have a clinical supervisor. It also fit with my mission and my own personal, you know, mission basically. But in those days, the pay was very low. And so I had to get used to and get comfortable with this balance of, you know, what's your personal income versus what is your career and what you want to do in life, and, you know, how to make all that work. And it did, it really did. And nowadays there's much more investment in early career mental health professionals, even in the community mental health system, and even competitive salaries with other professions is really good. But in those days, that was a little bit of a challenge. Just like all the new discoveries of these uncomfortable situations that you find yourself in, with whether it's ethical dilemmas or, you know, in my case, I worked with community mental health, which means there's a lot of involvement with other community partners, all that stuff can be pretty stressful, but it's also the kind of challenge that was fun for me. So I don't know. I think there's two sides to the coin on that question. With pretty much everything that came along, is there was a challenge, a stressful challenge, but a very rewarding challenge on the flip side of it.
That's awesome to hear about that, because most people just think like, oh, it's just a, you know, a clear path, but especially specific to you as being a master's level psychologist. And I don't mean to keep pointing that out, but I think it's so unique here in Kentucky that we offer that, and that how you came into, you know, your career and how you had to overcome like other challenges that maybe a PsyD or a PhD wouldn't have faced, but you were able to, you know, keep pursuing, and you kept, you know, fighting for where you were as a master's level psychologist.
Yeah, I think there was another challenge that came to me a few years in, which was this challenge of, is what I'm doing really working? Is it really making a difference? And this was an interesting challenge. There were times that I thought, we're not doing anything here. We're just spinning our wheels. We're seeing the same clients come in with the same problems. There's a lack of clarity on what the service is to these folks, and what we're doing. So about 10 years ago, I went to a training called Partners for Change Outcome Management System, PCOMS. A psychologist who's become a good friend of mine now named Barry Duncan created this system of using measurements at each session to have the client rate their own outcome and really guide their own treatment and their own improvements in treatment, and to really take specific steps to use that data to make clinical decisions along the way. And really the philosophy underneath of all of that is based on solid science about common factors of treatment. And the number one thing being that treatment is helpful. It's helpful to 80% of folks who seek treatment, and it has an overall effect size of 0.8. So psychological treatment is more effective than lots of medical treatments, even medical treatments that people think of as being pretty much solidly effective. So that was a bit of a relief. And then that whole system helped me get a grasp on the clarity of what I'm doing, and very specifically for each client, what kind of impact it's having on their life, instead of this just sort of trying to have some kind of intuition that's not anchored in anything about whether things are helpful or not. And I think really that may have been my biggest challenge now that I think about it, that once I got on the other side of that, I felt much better about what we're all doing, not just what it wasn't just a challenge for me. It's almost like a crisis that I was experiencing of the whole system, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a really big challenge. And I'm, since you're not practicing right now, but you said you're working with APA. So what is going on, you know, with your APA role that's really exciting to you right now?
Well, APA has a long history, really for generations, probably since its inception, of excluding master's level practitioners from the practice of clinical psychology, or health service psychology is the sort of more current term for that. And over the last 3 or 4 years, really with a lot of involvement from voices of folks on KPA, folks like David Sussman, who's very active in APA, and Eric Russ, who's very active in APA, Bill Stoops, and some of our folks that have over the last few years been, of course, Bill has moved out of the state now, but he was very involved in both KPA and APA. Those folks have carried the message to APA, along with other folks in APA, that there's really no threat and only an upside to including master's level folks in the practice of health service psychology. And the executive director of APA has also been very supportive of that notion. He actually came and spoke with us at one of our KPA events maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and that was one of the topics that came up. There's really a lot of upside, and one of the upsides is that inclusion of master's level practitioners really fits with the mission of APA, which is, I can't state it for verbatim, but it's something along the lines of disseminating the fruits of psychology for the betterment of society. And one of the things that we're seeing is that the majority of therapists, of mental health workers and therapists across the country, are not psychologists. They are counselors and social workers that are all trained at the master's level, or at least almost all trained at the master's level. Doctoral trained psychologists make up a minority of the practitioners that are actually delivering services. And that minority is even shrinking more as the other professions grow. So the fruits of psychology, especially when it comes to the proportion of practitioners, just keep shrinking in terms of the betterment of our society being, you know, coming from the source of psychology trained folks. So that, plus there's a social justice element of, on both sides, of folks that are less privileged and have less access to very time-consuming and expensive doctoral psychology programs just don't have access to that career path. That's one element, and it cuts out a lot of diverse, you know, potential diversity in the makeup of practitioners. And then the other is a lot of psychologists, doctoral level psychologists, tend to stay in higher socioeconomic areas where they deliver services, more urban areas and less underprivileged service areas. That's not 100%. It's not to say there aren't lots of doctoral folks that are out there working in underprivileged areas, but we see it in Kentucky that when you get outside of Lexington, Louisville, and Northern Kentucky, the number of doctoral level psychologists is very sparsely populated. So if you have master's level folks, they're more likely to go back to their communities, and you just have a more, you know, you're able to serve a more diverse population with that whole body of professionals. So with APA, we've been working on trying to convince all of the APA leadership and the folks that are the decision makers of those issues. And then how you get down in the details of how a master's level, what the rules, regulations, and guidelines and so forth are, and how that's going to plug into the current makeup of doctoral level psychology in all of the states. And it's really complicated because every state has their own licensing law. There's a lot of diversity of opinions in APA about how restricted or not a master's level practitioner should be in their practice. There's a debate about what the title should be for those practitioners. So there's just all of these issues that we keep hashing out and bringing more data to the table, bringing more ideas to the table, and trying to work collectively with people with a diversity of opinions can be quite a bit of a challenge. And I have to say that nothing has gotten off the rails or haven't been any major disputes at this point, doesn't look like there's going to be, but integrating all these diversity of opinions that conflict with each other has been a fun challenge. So I'm grateful to APA for including me, and they included me in this specifically because Eric Russ made a recommendation to them that I be included in it. So it's really the respect that APA has for the leadership at KPA that has allowed us to have a voice in this.
Yeah, that's really awesome to hear that, like, KPA is, you know, the reason you're there, and like how hard we work for master's level psychologists to continue practicing, and that they should have, you know, the same capability and the same opportunities as a doctoral level psychologist. So that's awesome that this is happening at a national level and that you're a part of it.
Yeah, just a couple more comments about KPA's commitment to master's level and how that has helped with this. One is that David Sussman, who has been in various positions on the KPA board and the APA council, his wife, Kathy, is also a KPA member, and she is a master's level practitioner. So just in that, David has a great voice and a great perspective. And for those who have heard David do trainings or speeches, he's very thorough in his, in the background of anything he's going to say or recommend. So that's given a lot of credibility to this whole thing. The other thing is that KPA has recently established a master's practice committee on the board. I should be a little more clear on the name of the committee, but it is it's led by Sarah Nolan, who's a KPA board member, and she's been very engaged in getting a lot of master's folks, you know, fired up about involvement with KPA and how that can be better for everybody.
Yeah, no, I love that we're continuing to, you know, fight the good fight for master's level psychologists. Like, as you said, like there are master's level psychologists out there, and they're just not getting the same opportunities as they should be, as they're, you know, like social workers and counselors that are, you know, going through these master's programs, and giving them the same, you know, even playing field that everyone else is getting. So that's really exciting work. And I'm really happy that you're a part of this. So we quickly touched on a couple influences through KPA. You said Dave Hanna and David Sussman quite a bit, which is awesome to hear. Are there any other prime influences in your life that helped shape your career and where you're at today?
Well, yeah, there are a handful of non-psychologists that were very important mentors to me. Folks like Ron Kibbe, who hired me and supervised and mentored me for many years. But as far as psychologists, folks involved in KPA or who have been involved in KPA, Kay Schaller was one of my first supervisors in a leadership role in community mental health. And Kay has been very involved in KPA. She's a master's level practitioner as well, and one of the first master's level folks to really have high level involvement in the KPA board, at least to my awareness. Also, Sheila Schuster, I have attended trainings and seen her on the news and heard her at conferences and all of that stuff for a very long time, since early in my career. And really, you know, I think it's a universal, reaction to Sheila's body of work over time that it's very inspiring. And let's see, there were other folks at my place of work that were involved in KPA early on. Folks like Kirby Neal and Trip Griesinger was a coworker of mine. There's a handful of other folks. Marion McClure and I worked together pretty closely along the way. We worked in some of the same offices, and really, she's one of the people. Folks like her and Trip were people that I used very regularly. Gordy Betts is another longtime KPA member who I worked closely with. And those folks, if I had a problem, I was the chief clinical officer of NuVista for several years, but I didn't just make unilateral decisions. I would bounce stuff off of folks like Marianne and Gordy and Trip, and when Dave Hanna was still there, Dave, of course. But those folks were always people I looked up to, and they really provided a level of integrity to all of our clinical decision-making processes that I relied on heavily, and they just were inspiring. Gordy was one of the first people that I worked with on any kind of policy group. And just his approach, he was the leader of our little committee we had coming up with policy for how to do threat assessments back in the late 90s. And it was very inspiring to see how he handled that. And it really was a model for me on how to conduct myself in those kinds of sort of policy leadership things.
Yeah, I'm happy you threw out a bunch of KPA members out there that are still active. So that just speaks volume about, you know, the impact we can make. And I'm glad those individuals were able to help, you know, shape you, and you were able to reach out to them with, you know, problems or issues that you saw that arose. So that's exciting to hear those names again.
Yeah, I want to mention another one who is a little bit different, because I didn't work with her a lot early on, but we were co-workers on the executive team at NuVista. This is Dee Werline, who is now the CEO of NuVista. She was the deputy commissioner for behavioral health for about 4 or 5 years before taking that role at New Vista just a month before my retirement. So we got to work together in that capacity for a month. And Dee is also a huge inspiration. Dee and I graduated from the same program just a couple years apart. So she's another master's level person who is really one of the top leaders in the state for behavioral health. So always inspired by her body of work over the years too.
Yeah, we are. And again, I was going to bring up, yeah, she's another master's level psychologist that's now, you know, running a huge organization, the New Vista, that's out in, I think, Lexington, right? So you've kind of, again, segued from your psychology. You've officially retired, even though you're still working with APA. What do you hope to achieve as a musician now? That's your career. Where do you see your goals going as a, musically?
Well, I keep grappling with that, really. The main goal I have is to just play with people playing music that I love to play and to keep that going. And there are several different things that deliver on that for me. I play multiple instruments and I play multiple styles of music. I play guitar, fiddle, mandolin, and banjo, and electric guitar. And I play old time traditional Kentucky music. I play bluegrass music. I play swing music. I play rock and roll. I play country. Americana, you might call, is probably the main thing that I play, like singer-songwriter, Americana-ish type stuff. Folk, I don't know, people call it all kinds of stuff. And I have a hard time having much of a preference for any one of those genres or any one way of being involved in it. You know, I like to write songs, I like to sing. I probably prefer playing an instrument more than I do singing, but I like it all. So I just want to be involved. I teach and want to promote Kentucky music. That's a clear goal I have, is wanting to promote Kentucky music and Kentucky musicians. There is a whole sort of crop of young, creative people from Kentucky. And honestly, most of them are from rural Kentucky. And it's very interesting to see these folks writing and creating new music at high levels. One of the people that I've known for several years and had some involvement with is a guy named Tyler Childers, who is you would probably have to call him a star of some nature. He just played the Stagecoach Festival and the Willie Nelson birthday party out in Southern California. I saw some pictures of a crowd that was probably 20,000, 30,000 people. I mean, massive crowds that he plays to. And several of my friends play in his band and have produced his records and that kind of thing. And the thing is, these people all live here. They did not move to Nashville. They, as a matter of fact, the fiddle player in that band and Tyler, the star, are both playing fiddles made by a fiddle maker from right here in East Kentucky, a guy named John Reister. So they are taking this Kentucky music thing to the ultimate extreme as far as they can. And they're staying here. They are, in the case of Tyler Childers, he is having the openers for his huge shows that he's having are Kentucky artists that are playing. He's, you know, every aspect of this that we're all trying to do is bring Kentucky artists, photographers, graphics designers, sound engineers, all of that. We want to promote from right here because there's a ton of very talented, smart people, mostly young people, mostly people quite a bit younger than me. And one of the things that we're trying to do along with that is anchor people in Kentucky traditional music, which is very rich. I'd say it's unmatched as a region for a long history of lots of different kinds of music. So I just want to be involved in that to the extent that I can, and just want to stay busy however I can in that world. I don't have big goals of having my own solo career or that sort of thing. I'm happy doing whatever, you know, going on little tours with artists or working in the studio. I was in the studio yesterday working with some great folks who have an exciting project coming up. I was at a big festival this weekend down in North Carolina playing, and my band, the Local Honeys, was playing. And along with that, a friend of mine named Cole Chaney was playing, and his band members are people that I grew up with. One of them grew up with my daughter, and one of them grew up with me. And they were like, why don't you just play with us? So we had a sort of Kentucky takeover of Western North Carolina on Saturday. And that stuff's just very exciting to watch.
No, that sounds really exciting. Yeah, since I moved to Kentucky, I've found a love for Kentucky music, specifically to what you're describing, to Tyler Childers. Finding that I really enjoyed it, and I enjoy listening to quite a bit, few of your songs as well. I know your Winetown album as well. We all got copies of those in the office. Do you have a local, or do you have a venue that you dream of playing at one day? Because there's one specifically that you would just absolutely love to be at. Where's the one? You know it.
Well, I really just did. I went to the festival I played at this weekend back in the 90s. It's a festival called Merlefest in Wilkesboro, North Carolina. And it had a lot of my stars in the bluegrass and progressive acoustic music world. People like Tony Rice and Bela Fleck and Sam Bush and all of these great players that are sort of rooted in bluegrass music, but play progressive music, you know, jazz and so forth. Those guys were my heroes back in the 90s. And we used to go to that festival every year. A whole group of us from Kentucky would go. And the last time I went was about 20 years ago. And I thought, I'd love to come back here and play, but I probably never will, because I'm working in community mental health and playing music on the weekends. But that's okay. But guess what? I got to go back and play this weekend. So that was one. I'm playing the Railbird Festival in Lexington next month, and that's also a very exciting place. I wanted to play that the first year they had it. I was like, that would be a great place. I don't care. I really don't. I love playing venues that hold a couple hundred people, you know, so I don't really care about playing in front of big groups of people. You know, I don't know.
I think that speaks volume about where you are as a musician. You know, have like a little more intimate setting with you know, people that really are passionate about the music, opposed to just filling seats.
I'll also bring up that my daughter is a musician. Her name is Grace Rogers, and she plays in a duo with another collaborator of mine named Blakely Berger. They live in Louisville, and they play in Louisville a bunch. So for all of the Louisvillians, go catch them out. They played, I watched them. I went to a show of theirs a few weeks ago at the Monarch, which is a new little place there on, I guess it's on Baxter or Bardstown Road, somewhere in that little section. And they're doing exactly what I'm talking about. They're both very steeped in traditional Kentucky music. My daughter is a banjo player who knows all these old mountain styles of banjo, and Blakely knows all these old fiddle tunes from all these traditional fiddle players that have long died and nobody knew who they were, but they play these great obscure old tunes. And these young people are just like on fire with this music, and then they're kind of stretching it out into their own creative thing too. So that's very exciting to watch.
Yeah, they're letting that like bluegrass legacy live on, even as music starts to change all the time. So that's really cool to hear. So I have one last question for you. It's not on the list, so I didn't make you prep for this one. I've asked all of my other guests, and you might have an answer because you are musically inclined. What karaoke song is your go-to? If you were to go on karaoke tomorrow or tonight or in the next 10 minutes, what song would you sing?
Well, I've never done karaoke, and I've always been scared of it. So I'd have to say maybe Friends in Low Places.
That's a good one. It's funny to hear. We had Courtney Kime on a couple episodes ago, and she comes from a very musical family, and her dad performs in bands and everything, and she was like, I'm actually too afraid of karaoke, I would never do it. So it's interesting to hear that someone that is so musically inclined and performs but maybe has never done karaoke. So it's just something fun we wanted to add in, but I appreciate your honesty on that. All right. Well, we will include in our show notes your band, the info about your daughter's band as well, what she's doing. And then we'll any other things where people can contact you or they can find you. What's the best way to get a hold of Don Rogers if they want to have me follow up with you?
Well, you can send me an email. My email address is flatbottom.don@gmail. You can also, I'm on social media, so you can find me on Instagram and Facebook, and you can send me a message there. That seems to be a growing sort of avenue of communication that people use. But yeah, I haven't said, you know, I'm aspiring to, you know, keep growing my musical career. I'm not beyond being involved in mental health and other psychology related things too. So you might find me back in various capacities with that someday too. So anyway. I'm still a certified trainer for PCOMs, and I'm in the training circuit at some point and stay involved in that.
That's great to hear. So Don Ryder's not giving up on his mental health work as he's pursuing his musical career. Again, thank you, Don, for joining us today, and we hope you all enjoyed this episode. Thank you.
Thank you all.